I'm Carol Tannehill, for those of you who don't know me, and I'm the director of the Glasgow Centre. And tonight, I just have the pleasure of welcoming you, reminding you please to switch off any phones or anything else that might ring or beep during the lecture. We are not expecting any fire alarms, so if anything goes off, the fire exits are behind you. And lastly, to draw your attention to the piece of paper that was on your seats when you arrived, which tells you the dates and titles of four more seminars in this series in the months of January, March, April and May. There may be one that comes in February, but if not, we look forward to seeing you in January, March, April and May. So without any further ado, I'd like to pass over to Professor Peter Holmes from the University of Glasgow, and Peter is going to chair this evening's session and introduce our speaker, Professor Bruce Link.
Thank you, Carol. Can I add my welcome? I'm from the University of Glasgow, as Carol said, and it's my pleasure to be the academic coordinator for what is a growing link between the Universities of Glasgow and Columbia University, New York. And that link has developed across a range of areas, and particularly in the biomedical area. And within biomedicine, public health has been identified as being a particularly valuable area in which there is potential for considerable collaboration between Glasgow and New York and many of the issues that confront communities in the cities of New York and Glasgow. So today's lecture very much fits in with that agenda. And it's a great pleasure to have Bruce Link and Jo, his wife, here today with us. As you possibly know, Bruce is Professor of Epidemiology and Socio-Medical Sciences at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, clearly a very important and very large public health school. He's also a research scientist at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. His research career has essentially focused on how and what conditions social and economic inequalities are translated into health disparities, which clearly is very much a theme of the Glasgow Centre for Population Health. Along with his wife Jo, they co-direct the Centre for the Study of Social Inequalities and Health at Columbia University. So it's a great pleasure to have him here with us today. And the title of his lecture, which was on the screen and has now disappeared. I'm sure it'll reappear again. Let me just remind you. Health Patterns and Trends in New York, Exploring the Idea of Fundamental Social Causes of Health Status. Bruce, we look forward to your lecture. Thank you.
Thanks so much for that nice introduction. It's really great to be here. I just wanted to say a couple things. First, I wanted to thank Andrew, especially Andrew Lyon and all of you, but especially Andrew Lyon for having arranged this and being such a terrific host. I wanted to acknowledge my wife, Jo Phelan, who's sitting in the front here, who really participated in all of the work I'll talk about today. And she's agreed to take all your tough questions later on. Part of the reason I'm so happy to be here is that I spent some time here a long time ago when I was an undergraduate. I actually spent some time in Edinburgh. And one of the things that I did in Edinburgh, I spent a semester there, is I took a course in Scottish history. And I remember in doing that, sort of reading about the struggles between England and Scotland, and somehow I always was rooting for the Scottish in those disputes. And I don't know, maybe it's the history, Americans had our disputes with the English too, I don't know. But at any rate, I feel this affinity for Scotland, have ever since I've been here, and it's exciting to be a part of this new connection between Glasgow and Columbia University, and it's great to be here and to be a part of Columbia in that undertaking. So let me now get us started. And I'll start us with some things that you'll find, you know, pretty familiar. But I'm going to start in my backyard. So here's New York City, all-cause age-adjusted death rates in the lowest versus the highest income neighborhoods in 2001. And what you see won't surprise you. The poorest neighborhoods have substantially higher age-adjusted death rates than do the wealthiest neighborhoods. And here's New York City age-adjusted death rates by race. And as you see there, you see this finding that's very prominent in the United States, whereby blacks who face more discrimination or usually have lower socioeconomic circumstances have higher death rates in New York City, both for males and for females. And then if you move from mortality to something like just self-rated health, how healthy you're feeling, here's New York City's percent fair or poor self-rated health by income level and as indicated by percent poverty level and race ethnicity. And what you see is within each, both overall, and within each of the major ethnic groups in New York City, there's this gradient that you're all familiar with respect to socioeconomic status and health. Now, you've heard of egocentrism, and you've heard of ethnocentrism, and there's something called New York centrism. New Yorkers have this odd way of thinking that the world revolves around our little island of Manhattan. And this is from the New Yorker magazine. And, you know, it's New Yorkers' conception of the United States. And, of course, there's 9th Avenue on it, 10th Avenue. And then if you can see, there's this tiny little strip, which is New Jersey. And the whole rest of the country is basically a barren wasteland. So this is the idea of New York centrism, and you may, by having me start you out with New York, have begin to think that I have this too. So let me take you to the United States as a whole and look here for what we find with regard to disparities. And this is by educational level, something that the United States didn't start to collect until the late 1980s. And this is all-cause age-adjusted death rates for people who are too young to die, really, 25 to 64. And you see this gradient once again. For both males and females, people with more education, much lower age-adjusted death rates. And if you go to race across the United States, you see much higher rates for blacks than for whites of age-adjusted death rates. And then in the United States, for fair or poor self-rated health, again, the same pattern that you saw in New York City. So you're beginning to see this idea that that these gradients are very prominent and exist many places. And not to be completely centric, here's a slide on age-adjusted death rates in England and Wales by your class system of occupational status, with the highest rates being in class 5, and then that gradient that we're so familiar with. And if we look at from in Scotland, this is Scotland's self-rated health by quintiles of income. And you see the same step-by-step linear gradient there. Now, we see this all the time, and I'm sure everyone in this room is familiar with this. It's almost like very predictable. You see it every place you look. So we could look at Western Europe, see similar kinds of things. So what do we do when we see these? What's our next inclination? What is it that we try to think about as being the next important thing to figure out? And I would say this, you know, simple diagram suggests what our logic likely often does. And that is to say, well, what are the mechanisms involved? What explains this association between indicators of socioeconomic status, like education or income or occupational position, and race, and morbidity and mortality? And if we look at the associations we just saw, here are some of the things that we'd likely start to think about. Differences in smoking behavior, differences in diet, different exercise, difference in levels of stress, and so on. And if you were me, before I started thinking like I'm just going to start telling you about how I think, you were me, you would tell yourself a couple of things in thinking about this. And the first thing you tell yourself is that if you could figure out what these things were, and we could have a longer list, if you could figure out what these things were, you would have explained to yourself why this connection between socioeconomic status and health existed. You would have figured out what the mechanisms were. That's one thing you'd likely tell yourself. The second thing you'd likely tell yourself is that if we can figure out what these intervening modifiable, at least some of them are partially modifiable, intervening factors are, you could make the SES association go away. because you'd figured out what the linking factors were and you could make it go away. And the third thing, when you look at that, the association between socioeconomic status and health, repeated over and over again in different places and at different times, you might think that, oh, it's the same thing in all those places. It's got to be the same thing. It's so prevalent, it has to be the same set of mechanisms. Now, what I'd like to do next is engage you in a mind experiment to see if we can think about this connection just slightly differently. And to do that, we'll go back in history. And we could tell this story about a lot of places. I'll tell the story about Rhode Island in the United States. So this is death rates per 1,000 people in Rhode Island in 1865. And didn't have great measures of socioeconomic status then, but the taxpayers were more wealthy than the non-taxpayers. And here are a few age categories. And what you see is there's always the same thing we saw in the current era. We saw, but we see a doubling or tripling of the death rates in the poorer group than in the richer group. Going forward in time to the 1930s in the United States, and we look at, this is again quintiles of the census tract that you live in, that's the area where you live in, from the highest to the lowest. You see the same gradient, and it's about double in the lowest as compared to the highest areas of living. Highest areas, census tract areas. So then, what's my point with this mind experiment? Well, imagine yourself back in Rhode Island in 1865 and doing what we just did for the current data. By meaning what we just did for the current data, that is trying to figure out what the mechanisms were. Well, the mechanisms would have been contaminated water, poor sanitation, crowded substandard housing, and the diseases would have been things like cholera, TB, and smallpox that people were dying from. These were the big killers at the time. And the interesting thing is, we did something about those risk factors. Largely cleaned up the water system, vastly improved the sanitation system. It's not like everybody has great housing in Rhode Island in the current era, but the housing is substantially better. And then we developed vaccines, and people don't die of TB, smallpox, and cholera in Rhode Island anymore. But the association, those are the things that would have explained, those would have been the mechanisms that explained the SES association back then. But now we see it in the current era, even though we got rid of all the intervening risk factors into your injury. There's something resilient about this connection between socioeconomic status and morbidity and mortality. And it's this line of thinking that leads to this idea of fundamental social causes. And we say that fundamental social causes involve resources such as knowledge, money, power, prestige, beneficial social connections that determine the extent to which people are able to avoid risks and adopt protective strategies so as to reduce morbidity and mortality. Now, this is the important part of this idea because it says that because such resources can be used in different ways in different situations, fundamental causes have effects on disease even when the profile of risk and protective factors and diseases changes radically. So that you can use these resources in different places in different times and they shape the pattern of disease outcome in those different places and times. And it's their persistent effect on health in the face of dramatic changes in mechanisms that leads us to call them fundamental. Now, we don't want to over-privilege these things as being the only thing that's important. Clearly, many other things are important for health. And it would be useful if you're thinking along the lines of tagging certain types of causes. We're using this term fundamental causes to refer to this process, but you could talk about genetic causes as original causes. You could talk about the final biological pathways as essential causes. But we wanted a term to point to these kinds of causes that keep reproducing the connection between socioeconomic status and health as fundamental causes. And we think about them operating at two levels. One is sort of the individual level. People use their knowledge, what they know, they use their money, they use their power, they use their prestige and beneficial connections to obtain healthy outcomes. You can see yourself doing that if you face a health crisis or if your spouse does. You use everything you've got to try to get the best situation you possibly can. But resources also provide access to generally salutary contexts, to neighborhoods, to occupational conditions or marriages, So events, just for example, for neighborhoods, and I'll give you one personal example around the neighborhood, and that is that I live in a, on a block, and two houses down, there's a woman who lives in a much smaller house, but she happens to be, it's this phenomenon of beneficial connections, who's very well connected. Now, there's a very tiny risk of a man my age walking out on a snowy morning and shoveling snow, getting a heart attack. It's a tiny, tiny risk. And when the snowplows come by, they pile up the snow in front of your driveway. You want to get your car out, you got to go out there and shovel it out. But the woman down the road's well connected. And across from our house is a park. It wouldn't be a park if I was a poorer person. It's a park. So there's no reason not to plow the snow into the park rather than on our driveways. And so this woman has organized and used her clout to have them shovel the snow on the other side. And I have a slightly better health profile as a consequence. Now, the idea here is that, oh, you extend that to all the other details of life. My neighbors are helpful in keeping out crime, pollution, noise, making sure that there's fruits and vegetables in the local markets because they want them. This all helps me, and I don't have to do anything. It's just there. It's a package deal that comes along with my neighborhood. Same thing's true of my occupation. U.S., we don't all get health care. I get health care as a part of my occupation. And that my job, they negotiate the good conditions for that and so on. And it's not a dangerous job and the like. And then marriages. If the higher your SES, the more likely you are to marry someone who's also of higher education and income. And that person's resources, their knowledge about health, can be helpful to you. So as all these things can come along as sort of a package deal in the fundamental causes idea. Okay. Now I'm going to take you to someplace you wouldn't think I'd go next. And that is to the dramatic improvement. And the reason you might not think I would go this in this direction is that sometimes social epidemiologists, people like me, we tend to focus on the bad things. We're intrigued by obesity epidemics and the like. So here's, I want to turn our focus to something that's very positive and that's been going well. And that is life expectancy in the United States. This is life expectancy since 1950. My dad was born about here. My daughter was born about here. This huge, dramatic change that's occurred in terms of life expectancy over a relatively short period of time, the life expectancies of two people I know. And it's true in Scotland, too. Males and females, much better. Turns out that the United States and Scotland aren't the top of the world, but within the United States and Scotland, life expectancy is growing up substantially. That is, we're not the best with respect to life expectancy. And it's broad-based. You go to heart disease, dramatic decline in heart disease mortality over time since the 1950s, you know, less than half of what it was in 1950 in the year 2000. Go to something like cancer in the United States, the rates went up until about the 1990s, and now they've been coming down. The yellow line is stroke, goes down dramatically over this period. So this is happening with the major killers. If you go to an infectious disease like flu, it's on its way down. HIV went up until they discovered the antiretroviral drugs, and now it's coming down. This is Scotland. Went up and stayed stable for a while for men, and heart disease mortality dropped dramatically. It's dropped for women as well. This is lung cancer in Scotland. Went up for men, then dropped substantially. Gone up and leveled off, and it's just beginning to drop down for women. And some people worry, well, this is about mortality. Maybe we're living longer, but living worse. This slide is indicative of maybe, you know, that this, not only living longer, but we're feeling healthy over time. This is from the General Social Survey in the United States. This is a survey that's done in the United States every 2 years, and it's been done since 1972 to 2004. And what this shows is the percentage of people saying they have good or excellent health when they were born at different periods. So if you're born in the 1910s, 57% of the people, when they were interviewed, and they're age 60 to 69, 57% of them indicated that they had good or excellent health if they were born in 1910. And part of this every 2 years survey. And if it's 1920s, it's 63%. And if it's 1930s, it's 74%. So that this is indicative of this is evidence suggesting that not only is mortality going down, life expectancy going up, but people are actually feeling healthier. They report that they feel healthier over time. So what's the point here? Well, something's driving these dramatic improvements in health. And we can label it for now X. What is this X thing? And what I want you to start to think about is, shouldn't whatever this X is be an important part of our explanation of health disparities? Because it's been such a huge trend in the United States and across the world towards improved population health. And shouldn't whatever's driving that be some part of our explanation of disparities? And if we stop and think about, how do we often try to explain disparities, here are some of the things we might think about. We might think about genetic factors as being explanatory of the disparities that we observe in the current era. But if we were to think, the genetic factors can't be the only thing that's responsible for that great, big, dramatic movement towards improved population health. The change has occurred too fast for it to be genetic factors alone. What about stress? Well, stress, we'd have to argue that our lives have become less stressful. Anybody want to raise their hands and vote for that one? Probably. I mean, maybe it was more stressful, and maybe we have the image that our lives are stressful and that it's more congenial in an earlier period of time. But from my field of psychiatric epidemiology, the evidence seems to suggest, it's not everybody agrees with it, but that rates of depression are going up in younger cohorts. And people have even postulated something as Agent Blue, feeling to make people feel down and blue and depressed. It's causing the increase in depression over time. And so can we really think that stress has been declining? Well, what about social involvement and participation? Is voting going up dramatically to have produced any change like the one we saw? What about income inequality? Well, in the United States, at least, income inequality has gotten much worse. It's much wider spread than it used to be. It can't be the explanation for these improvements. It's not the same thing that's driving these improvements in health. So then what is this X thing? Well, it's not just any one thing, but it's probably many things. So the discovery of the germ theory is a strong candidate for declines in rates of infectious disease in the first half of the 20th century. Recent declines in age-adjusted death rates from lung cancer are probably influenced by the lagged effect of declines in smoking rates in earlier decades. The rapid decline in HIV/AIDS mortality is probably related to the antiretroviral drugs that were developed and disseminated in the 1990s. And then there's screening for disease, public health efforts to increase consumption of fruits and vegetables, promote exercise, eradicate smoking, smog control, flu shots, seat belts, angioplasty, screening for early detection of cancer, and on and on and on, long list. So X is clearly this thing that's driving population. It's clearly not one thing, and it's likely different things for different diseases and probably different things at different times. But the confluence of all these things has clearly had an enormously positive impact on population health. So clearly, human beings have dramatically increased their capacity to control disease and death. And then we connect that to this fundamental cause reasoning that I introduced you to a few minutes ago. And it says that our enormous capacity to control disease and death, combined with social and economic inequality, is what creates health disparities. It's sort of a simple idea. It does so because of a very basic principle. When we develop the ability to control disease and death, the benefits of this newfound capacity are not distributed equally throughout the society or the population, but are instead harnessed more securely by individuals and groups who are less likely to be exposed to discrimination and who have more knowledge, money, power, prestige, and beneficial social connections. People who are more advantaged with respect to resources such as these and who are less likely to be held back by discrimination benefit more and have lower death rates as a consequence. And disparities are the result. So it's a connection between our capacity to control disease and death and inequality that generates disparities is the proposition that's being put forward. And then let's think about how this might happen. Can we trace through a few examples? Now, I'll give some examples, and then I'll really develop one in a little bit more detail. So if you think about the Titanic sinking, so when bad things happen, do social conditions shape the outcome? Well, if the Titanic sinks, then the death rates go by the class of the cabin that you are in. And the people in the lower class cabins are much more likely to die than the people in second class, and the group with the fewest dying were in the first class. And the WTC is the World Trade Center. When the terrorists attacked us in New York City, they attacked us at the center of our power. That's what they wanted. That was what they were after. That's who they really wanted to get. So it happens, and then social structure comes in. Because what happens is the powerful start going down the steps, and the blue-collar firemen and police are running in. And the people who are running down the steps tell stories about the firemen hauling the hoses up into the tower. And the people going down the steps, some of them get out, and the ones who went up with the hoses died. It's not like immediately there's the social shaping of that event. And then that's Hurricane Katrina, this horrible circumstance that happened with the hurricane in New Orleans, and that was very dramatically shaped by social consequences. And then you can think about that with all the day-to-day tragedies that occur in people's lives. And that sort of makes sense, because when bad things happen, they're shaped by social factors. But what about when good things happen? For example, when we discover that smoking is harmful to health, or we develop new technology like cancer screens and the like. And here the idea is that when we discover good things for health, the same process applies whereby people with more knowledge, money, power, prestige, and beneficial social connections are more likely to be able to benefit from that newfound capacity. I'm going to develop one of those. It'll be a familiar story to you, but I want to show it to you and have you think about it from this lens that I'm developing about fundamental causes and the idea of the social shaping of events. And the interesting thing here is that we have some data about how people thought about smoking and lung cancer for a long period of time in the United States. There's a series of studies done by public opinion researchers, the nationwide Gallup surveys, and they did some quite early on. And these data are available, and so we'll be able to look at what's happened since 1954. Now, in the smoking, these surveys were done just after the information from the cohort studies had been published, showing a link between smoking and death from lung cancer. The case control studies had been done a couple of years earlier, so this is when the really dramatic evidence was about to come out. And this slide says this is about the percent of people who said that they'd heard anything about cigarette smoking being a cause of cancer. There's a couple things to notice in this slide. First thing is that a lot of people had heard this news. So it's not like, you know, they hadn't heard about this. And the second thing to notice is this somewhat of a gradient occurred right away, that people of higher SES with 16 or years more of education much more likely to have heard about it than people with less than 12 years of education, the beginning of this social shaping. It didn't transfer immediately into the belief that smoking causes cancer. So this is the percent responding yes to a question asking whether smoking is a cause of lung cancer by education in 1954, this very early period. And here there's two interesting things to notice. One is that only a minority of people believe that even after this evidence had come out, that smoking could be a cause of cancer. And it was pretty flat with respect to SES. An SES gradient had not emerged here in this belief that smoking is a cause of cancer. Then going forward, here's what happened in the United States. Here are the early years that I just showed you. A dramatic, everybody now believes, almost everybody believes that smoking is a cause of lung cancer in the United States. But it took a long time. It took from 1954 to 1999 for that change in people's sets of beliefs to occur. And here you see what happened with respect to the SES gradient in that belief. This is back when the association was fairly flat. And then you can see that by 1969 and 72, a gradient had begun to emerge. It was still there in 77 to 85. Now, almost everybody believes it, but there's still somewhat of a gradient in the belief that smoking is a cause of lung cancer. And then if you go to the smoking behavior from these same surveys, the trend has definitely been downward, almost monotonic, uniform, step-by-step downward over time. And here's the SES gradient by of smoking over those periods. So if you go back into the early period, there is no strong gradient with respect to SES. In fact, the highest group smoked a little bit more than the lowest group, and there was no strong gradient. There's still no strong gradient in 69 to 72. Then it begins to open up, and now it's fairly prominent with respect to education and smoking behavior. But this, one point is that this took a long time to occur, and then it begins to be shaped by socioeconomic status. And when we learn new life-saving information, smoking is a cause of lung cancer, it then ends up being shaped by socioeconomic factors. It couldn't have been shaped in an earlier period when we didn't know that information that smoking causes cancer. And when we learn it, then it ends up coming to be shaped by socioeconomic factors. And then here's the end of the story. If you look at, this is age-adjusted lung cancer mortality among men from 1950 to 1998. And the thing that you find here is this is sort of like the best SES information we have in the United States. This is the lowest quintile of the county in which you live in terms of median income and the like. And this is the highest. If you go back to 1950, lung cancer rates were higher in the higher SES areas. That line begins to flatten out, flattens out relatively soon compared to the low SES. It continued to rise and only began to drop at the end. So the social shaping ended up being a social shaping of the SES association with lung cancer over time. So here's a couple of points to be made from this very familiar story about smoking. It exemplifies the process specified by the fundamental cause theory. There's a social shaping of new knowledge, and this social shaping creates health disparities by socioeconomic status. The story sensitizes us to the fact that other forms of health knowledge and technology are also shaped in this way. So one of the very interesting findings came from this guy Skinner at Dartmouth College in the United States. And what he looked at was in the U.S. was what areas of the United States were quickest to adopt the use of relatively inexpensive beta blockers for addressing heart disease. And what he found that it was the same areas of the United States, the same states within the United States, were quick to pick up beta blockers and use them and save lives in their states, as were the same states had picked up hybrid corn some 30 years earlier. And it is also true that the same states were the first one to adopt personal computers and a special kind of tractor that was more efficient. So that this said that there's something, you know, sort of deeply social about the spread of these innovations. And that it wasn't just about medicine, it wasn't just the medical establishment, but something about these areas that made this spread of a very useful and health-protective new innovation spread differently across the United States. And then the third point I'd make about the smoking story is the length of time it takes for knowledge and behavior to change and to spread is very instructive. It's not simply a matter of being smart enough to know the evidence and act. Because if that had been true in 1954, most of the people had heard about it, they would have changed their behavior. And so again, it's likely deeply social, and this tells me an important story about the emergence of health disparities. And let me just say what that important story is. It's what I like to do with this slide is imagine ourselves jumping into a different slice of time than we exist in now, and thinking how we might have thought, or how some people might have thought, at that particular slice of time. So let's now insert ourselves into 1969 and 1972. And most of us are in this group, have a college education or more. And let's imagine us thinking, well, what's going on with these folks? The information's been around for a long time. It came out in 1954. Everybody should, the Surgeon General's asserted it. Everyone should know that smoking's bad for your health. What's wrong with them? The them, down there at the lower end. And the interesting, so if we could have that way of thinking in 1969 and 72, and then transport ourselves, the same us, the ones who have college educations or more, into the current era, and have a look. Well, it turns out that the them, the people who were the them back in 1969-72, are doing the well as the us were back in 1972. In other words, it's not something about the people on the bottom. It's about this spread, this social change that occurred, the changes in the norms. And they changed more slowly in the lower socioeconomic group than they did in the higher socioeconomic group. But there's nothing fundamental about these people. They can't get the message because they did so just a little bit later. And it has something to do with our policies and so on about why it should be so just a little bit later. And you could tell the same story for the smoking behavior. And so if you go back to 1972, this is the us. The them who have less than 12 years of education, just 15 or 20 years later, are doing a little better than the us back in 1972. And here's an interesting and a kind of embarrassing story about the United States. This is the percent of the American citizens who believe that the sun goes around the earth and that sound travels faster than light. So that 24% of Americans believe that the sun goes around the earth, and 22% believe that sound is faster than light. And the reason I put this up, not to just embarrass Americans that we haven't done better with respect to education, but the message, this is among people who believe that the sun goes around the earth and that sound travels faster than light, who think that smoking is a cause of cancer. So even the people who believe that the sun goes around the earth have gotten this message. So this message can basically be delivered to everyone. All right, so now I've been talking about an idea, laid out the idea, and I walked through a mechanism whereby we could think of how it routinely occurs. Now, you might then want to say, well, is there any way to put this idea to some kind of a test, a risky test? And we throw it out there against empirical evidence and see whether it comes up and works. So now we say that SES differences arise because people of higher socioeconomic status use these flexible resources to avoid risks and adopt protective strategies. It follows that the SES gradient should be more pronounced for diseases that we can do something about, for which there are known and modifiable risk and protective factors. So then our first test is going to involve ratings of the preventability of death in specific causes. And we're going to use something called the U.S. National Longitudinal Mortality Survey. It's a huge study, over 350,000 people around the United States. And there are interviews as part of the U.S. Current population survey. This is what keeps track of our unemployment statistics and so on. And then they're followed for 9 years forward in a prospective manner by the National Death Index for mortality and for cause of death. And they find what I've showed you before in this study. This is from the study when it was first published in 1995. They find the same kind of gradient that you find so commonly, both by income and for both males and females. Now, what we're trying to investigate is whether we can find a situation that's consistent with our thinking that where this gradient is not so pronounced as we see it here. So we're thinking that if we look at diseases that we can't prevent, we don't know how to prevent death from those diseases or prevent the diseases from occurring, then we should find a flatter gradient, because we're pointing to this our ability to avoid disease and death as being a major cause of health disparities. So this is the rating task we gave to two famous social epidemiologists, Anna D'Estru and Chiro Kouachi. And we asked them, thinking both of our ability to prevent a disease from occurring and treat it once it occurs, to what degree was it possible in the early 1990s to prevent death from this disease? And we have them rate each disease for which a cause of death had been registered in the National Death Index. And they rated on a 5-point scale from virtually impossible to prevent to virtually all deaths preventable. And they were quite reliable with each other, and it correlated with an independent set of ratings that were similar in a manner that gave us some confidence, enough confidence to test our hypothesis using the ratings. And here's some examples of low preventability causes of death and high preventability causes of death. So low preventability with things like brain cancer, ovarian cancer, gallbladder cancer, multiple sclerosis, and pancreatic cancer. And high preventability were lung cancer, ischemic heart disease, colon cancer, and pneumonia. And the idea here is that for a disease like brain cancer, for all intents and purposes, me and George Bush and the guy who sells me my coffee on the corner of 168th Street in Manhattan have about the same chance of dying from that disease, because we really don't know too much about how to prevent it or how to cure it once it's occurred. That may be a slightly overdrawn, but we have much less capacity to address this disease than we have to address these diseases. So we don't expect a gradient with respect to low preventability diseases. Me and George Bush and the guy who sells me the coffee are pretty much in the same boat with respect to these diseases, but we're not with these diseases. George Bush has a heart attack, you know, he's going to get the absolute best. I'll get pretty good, and the guy who sells me that coffee could be in trouble. And so here's what we found, show you just a couple of examples. We used education here. We also did it with income and got pretty much the same things. What you're seeing here is the percent dying in the 9-year follow-up period, and this is of rather young ages. And you see a sharp gradient for the high preventability diseases, and a slight gradient, but not nearly as sharp a one as you do for the high preventability, for the low preventability. This is relatively flat. It's true if you use either the relative risk or if you use the gaps between the lines. And if it's even a little more striking, if you go to an older age group, 45 to 64, high preventability, the sharp gradient, this is the one we've come to expect. This is the one we think is driving the gradient that we see all the time, are more the high preventability causes of death than the low preventability. So, and this one's flat and this one's a sharp gradient. We tested this statistically and determined that this gradient is significantly greater than this gradient for both education and income. So this is a test of the idea. A second way to kind of test the idea is to look at evidence of the hypothesis of trends over time. So if this core proposition is true, we should find that disparities by SES and race emerge when new health-enhancing information or technology is obtained. So for example, it's occurred for heart disease, Hodgkin's disease, and colon cancer, but if it remains largely unpreventable or less preventable than other diseases, disparities will not change dramatically with time. So brain cancer, ovarian cancer, or pancreatic cancer. So we'll look at trends by race. The United States has much better trends by race because we didn't start keeping socioeconomic evidence until the late 1980s on death statistics. And we'll start with the diseases that are low in preventability. And this is consistent with the idea, this is brain cancer, it's consistent with the idea it's low preventability, the line's not going down. What we find is that white males have higher age-adjusted death rates than black males, happens to be true. But there's no crossing of the lines. We don't see anything moving here for these diseases that we don't know anything what to do about. Same thing's true for ovarian cancer, pretty flat lines. There's a gap between blacks and whites. It happens to be that white females have slightly higher rates of death than this. Go to pancreatic cancer, blacks tend to have higher rates. But again, you don't see the lines coming down and you don't see them crossing. But now let's change our focus and start to think about diseases that we have dramatically improved our ability to deal with those diseases. And look at heart disease first. So if you went back to 1950, the early studies, the descriptive epidemiology, described it as a disease of white people and also people with higher SES. But here, consistent with the idea that we've done, learned how to deal with the disease, the lines are on their way down, but the disparity opens up over time, such that the disparity that we see in the current area is one that was produced over time. If we go to all cancers combined, here's the findings for blacks and whites. Blacks used to be slightly lower, went up, and now the disparity disadvantages blacks. With respect to breast cancer, this is what you see. You're seeing the lines crossing, so the disadvantaged group is ending up with a higher rate over time. Same is true for colon cancer. And for some of these, you can tell fairly compelling stories. I can't prove these stories, but they're stories that are consistent with the pictures. So that there's something like a poor person's diet, collard greens, beans, and the like, not high in red meats when blacks were very poor. As their socioeconomic status rose, their rates of colon cancer rose, whites are coming down. The current disparity is one that emerged over time. It wasn't something that existed all the time in nature. It's something that was produced over time. And if you go to, this is to look at some figures about SES. This is, again, the SES of the county you live in, because we don't have it on individual SES. And here you see age-adjusted cancer, all cancers combined. Used to be higher in the higher SES. It flattened out quicker in the higher SES, dropped faster. Current disparity that we see is one that emerged over time. And this is to take one specific cancer, colon cancer, you see the lines connecting, and the current disparity being one that was created over time. Some people worry that, well, you're using only mortality data. Does this happen with anything that doesn't have to do with mortality? Here's a story about high cholesterol above 240. And if you go back to 1971, 1976, 80, what you see is that the people that are below the poverty level had lower cholesterols than people that are 200% above the poverty level or between 100 and 200% of the poverty level. And that was also true in 76 and 80. There's this period of equality. If you came down, you would have found no disparity in 1988 to 1994. But by 2001, there's a disparity with the lower SES group having the highest rate of high cholesterol. So when we examine race and SES disparities in mortality by particular diseases, we find dramatic evidence that such disparities are created over time. Groups with more resources and who face less discrimination benefit more greatly from our newfound capacity, and disparities emerge. This means that explanations that propose relatively unchanging causes of disparities like genes, relative deprivation, social participation can't be the main reasons for health disparities. So that if you're thinking genes and you're thinking race and genes, I don't like doing that, some people do, but if you had that thought, you came along and you took a slice of time, you jump into that slice of time, you jump into 2000, you could develop an idea that maybe the difference between blacks and whites is due to some genetic phenomenon. Now, the trouble is, where was the gene there and why wasn't it working there to produce the opposite effect? I have that trouble in looking at that picture and using that explanation. Or to use a picture like this and imagine, well, the reason that the lower SES people have higher rates of lung cancer is they look around and they see other people have more than they do and they sort of give up on life and it just doesn't matter, so I'm going to smoke a cigarette because they have more than I do. And that would be, that kind of reasoning would be consistent with that picture, but it's not really consistent with that picture, unless you add in something else. Because it's still the same low SES people looking around. And so it's hard to use constant explanations to explain these changing patterns over time. Now, I can either stop and take questions, or I can talk about, you know, what might this mean for policy. So I'll leave this up to anybody who wants to. You want to talk to me, or you want to hear what I... You'd like to listen? All right. Okay, so I'll... Whoops, did that move? Oh, no. So I'll talk about three things quickly. Because I think it has slightly different... Some of them are obvious, but some are more or less so. And maybe you'd like to hear what I think anyway. So first is, and this is the more obvious one, social policies that provide resources to the resource poor. The second one is population health policy that focuses on changing contextual factors that affect everyone in the context, regardless of resources. And the third one is to do something that I like to think about as population health policies that contextualize individual risk. I'm sure some of you have thought a lot about these things, but let me just say a little bit about them. So social policies that provide resources to resource poor. You know, I wish I was this powerful, but let's imagine that we lopped off the lower end. That is, we gave more resources to low SES people. We got rid of that line. And then our gap would be lower between the richest and the poorest in the country, or the most educated and the least educated, if we were able to diminish the extent of social inequality. Now, it's sometimes people look at that and they say, well, you can't really do that. You know, it's not going to work. It's a capitalist society. But I like to think about it that we're always doing things like that with respect to policy in terms of taxation and the like. It's just that they're not usually thought about as health policies and having health implications. So that they are things that we can change. And in the United States, we've changed them by making them worse, making the gap between the rich and the poor much larger than it used to be. So my thinking is that if we did things to make it worse, greater, we could also do things to make it narrower. It is in our power. It's a matter of whether we have the will to do it. And then sometimes when I give this talk, especially to people who are out in the streets trying to address the health disparities, there's a tone in it that, gee, this is going to happen no matter what. Because the people with more resources, no matter what the health conditions are going to use their resources to generate a health disparity. The people on the top and make sure they get the best situation. And there's something depressing about that if you're out there trying to do things to reduce the disparity. So the thing I like to think about is that, in that regard, is that the slope of the disparity can either be worse or better. And we can try to make it less bad than if our policies could go forward and make it worse, so it's sharper, it could make it less. And, you know, maybe ideally we could do something whereby we make it a little bit better for everybody. So high SES would have a flatter slope. So that's one thing I like to think about, is that that gradient, whatever it is a flexible gradient, just like the resources are. And what things that we do to try to minimize it can help. So that just because we might not make it go away in any particular area doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to make it less steep than it is in the current era. So another thing that I think, and this is not a way of thinking that's particularly congenial in where I come from, in the country as a whole, in the United States, because we're very individualistic in our reasoning. And one of our major ways of trying to affect health is to get personal about it and personalize health and put health in the hands of the individual. And the idea there is that when we do that, when we give all the responsibility to the individual, those with more resources are more likely to be able to use those resources to get an advantage. But what if we could think, as we have in some cases, about more contextual types of interventions? So that if we're thinking about dental caries, you know, think about an intervention that affects everyone, like fluoridation, versus one like flossing, where you have to have the time, the kids can't be screaming, you know, to do the flossing, and you have to remember to do it and take the responsibility to do it and so on. Whereas fluoridation helps everybody regardless. It just has to be in your teeth. And then airbags versus seatbelt. The airbags you have to hitch up, the seatbelts, seatbelts you have to hitch up, the airbags will help you no matter what. Or with respect to lead paint, cleaning up lead paint versus handing out leaflets to tell parents how to keep their children from ingesting the paint chips. The latter intervention, the parents with fewer kids, more time, and more kind of know-how and so forth, are more likely to protect their kids than poor people with tons of kids, have to go work, don't have anybody to look after the kids, and so on. So, and then neat inspection versus information to carefully wash cutting boards. In the United States, we're told to carefully wash our cutting boards. That's something where you have to have time, the knowledge, and so on to do. Whereas if you inspect the meat so it isn't contaminated, you'll protect everybody. And could we think of more things like that as our interventions? And if we were able to think of more things that help everyone together, population health interventions, then we would be able to reduce disparity. It wouldn't induce a disparity. And then finally, if the interventions require individual action, then the idea would be to put a context around those risk factors. That is, find out what puts people at risk of risk, and then try to intervene broadly and comprehensively to remove existing barriers to individual action directed to ourselves. So the last thing I pointed to was population health things. You can't do that for absolutely every health intervention. For example, you have to go individually to get your colonoscopy. It just has to be you. So what you try to do if you're concerned about disparity is try to think about all the contextual barriers that might exist for somebody with less knowledge and less resources. So that's the back to the New Yorker cartoon. I hope I haven't been speaking a foreign language, though sometimes I worry that I have in terms of speaking American here. But I thank you very much for your attention. I'm interested to hear what you have to say.